This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodl Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Megan has been doing the news for us since the very beginning of the Jodcast, but we don't actually know, I think, that much about what sort of research you do. So could you tell us a bit about that?
Sure. Well, you might have picked up on maybe what my favourite topics are from what tends to end up in the news each month. I study galaxies. In particular, I watch galaxies crash into each other. So my interest is in the technical term is we call them starbursts. So these are galaxies that have high rates of star formation. So more stars are forming in them than are currently forming in the Milky Way. So the Milky Way is not a starburst galaxy. It's an ordinary, fairly straightforward, boring spiral galaxy, if spiral galaxies can be described as boring. But some other galaxies are far more active. So this could be because there's been a collision or a close encounter with another galaxy. And what happens in these cases is you get an interaction between the two, and the gravitational interaction between the galaxies causes gas to start collapsing under gravity. And when that starts to happen, as the cloud gets denser and denser, it gets heavier and heavier, and that pulls more gas in around it, and it gets heavier still, which pulls more gas in, and eventually you get these cores turning into young stars. And if you have massive clouds of gas in a galaxy, what happens when these collisions occur and this collapse starts to happen is you get very massive stars forming. And when you get very massive stars forming, those are the ones that tend to explode as supernovae. So you might have noticed there's, you know, been the odd supernova story in the news over the last few years. Is it happens to be one of my areas of interest. So you get these galaxies where you can actually measure the star formation rate by looking at how many supernovae go off in them. And that's one of the things that I've been studying with radio telescopes over the last few years.
Okay, so these are the galaxies where all the fun stuff is happening in the universe, basically.
Well, there's a lot of fun stuff. I wouldn't say all of the fun stuff, but there's an awful lot of fun stuff happening in them, yes.
You just mentioned that you study them in the radio. So are they particularly amenable to being studied in radio frequencies?
Well, they're actually pretty interesting across the whole electromagnetic spectrum. So if you look at one of my favourite galaxies, which is M82, I studied M82 quite a lot for my PhD. M82 has an awful lot of optical emission. It's an edge-on galaxy that's been through a close encounter with M81. So it's quite a disturbed system. Because it's edge-on, we can't tell what its spiral structure is directly because we can't see it. All we see, we're looking through the plane of the disk. It's like looking through the plane of the Milky Way. All you see is a strip of stars across the sky. You don't see that spiral structure. It's the same thing in M82. It's edge-on to our line of sight. But if you look at it in the optical, you see all sorts of dust lanes and all the rest of it. And this is stuff that's been sort of moved around and created. Some of the dust has been created in these supernovae explosions, which have happened because of the starburst activity. But you've also got, if you look in other wave bands, so if you look in things like hydrogen alpha, which is a particular spectral line of the hydrogen atom, what you see are these enormous great big clouds of gas that sort of start from the centre of the galaxy and spread above and below the plane of the galaxy. And the idea, we think, is that those are actually being thrown out by the star formation. So these young massive stars have very powerful stellar winds that blow the gas out from the disk. And the supernovae do the same thing. Supernovae is basically a huge shockwave that ripples through the interstellar medium surrounding it and actually pushes the gas away from the explosion. So we think that these enormous great big sort of chimneys of material are caused by this star formation activity in the middle. So they're really interesting in the optical. But if you look at them in the ultraviolet, they're also really interesting because in the ultraviolet you see the young hot stars because they emit a lot of their light in the ultraviolet part of the spectrum. So that can tell you something about the stellar population. The infrared is also quite interesting. One of the things with starburst galaxies is because you've got so much dust, you actually can't see very far into them in the optical because that dust blocks the light. It's like the dust lanes in the Milky Way. They look dark to us because there's just no light coming from behind them because the dust gets in the way. But with infrared and with radio as well, what you can actually do is look through those dust lanes and see further into the galaxy. So infrared can tell you something again about the stars, the stellar population in the galaxy, and the radio can look through those dust lanes and actually see not only supernova remnants in the disk of the galaxy that you wouldn't see any other way, and supernovae themselves as well in some cases, but you can also actually look through galaxies and look at the background quasars, the background AGN in the distant universe. And those active galaxies are actually quite interesting because they can tell you something about the medium in the galaxy, in the foreground galaxy itself, between you and the background quasar. So there's all sorts of things you can do with these galaxies, and there are lots of X-ray sources, gamma-ray sources. Pretty much any wave band you're interested in, starburst galaxies are interesting.
So you did your PhD at Jodrell Bank, and I think you actually grew up not very far away. So did the telescope or the observatory have any kind of effect on you? Did you know about it when you were growing up?
I did, yes. And I think there is a slight chance that it might have played some part in where my career path eventually took me. Yeah, I grew up in a town called Macclesfield, which is not very far from Jodrell Bank at all. And the first time I think I went there, I was probably about 5. And when I was about 11 or so, I think I joined the local astronomical society, which met at the observatory. So I've been going to Jodrell Bank way before I started doing my PhD. I've been going there once a month anyway for those kind of meetings. So I've had a very long association with the place. So yeah, I think it played quite a significant part in my sort of eventual career path as an astronomer.
That sounds familiar to me because I grew up in Manchester and we also went on a couple of visits to Jodrell Bank, which I certainly never forgot. And it was kind of interesting to get to the other side, to get to the inside of the observatory finally after all those years. Yes. And I feel it must have made some impression somewhere.
I think it probably has on an awful lot of people. It is really sort of bizarre the first time you go across the fence and you're sort of in the research side of the building. Yes, it's very strange. Yeah.
You had this long association with Jodrell Bank, and then in 2008, I think you moved almost as far away as you could possibly have gone, all the way to Perth, where you are now in Australia. So what was the, what sort of things did you find there that you're working on now?
That's right. Yeah. I left Jodrell Bank on the Friday and I started in Perth on the Monday. So it was a weekend of traveling. Yeah, so I've moved to Perth and I'm working now for an organisation called ICRA, which is the International Centre for Radio Astronomy Research, which is a joint institute between the University of Western Australia and Curtin University, which is my employer. And so I'm a postdoc, and postdocs are basically researchers who are paid to just do research sort of after you finish your PhD. What I've been working on here recently is actually working on this technique of joining radio telescopes together, this VLBI technique that has been covered a few times on the Jodcast. So with an ordinary radio telescope, when you actually look at the sky, the resolution, the amount of detail you can see is actually pretty poor for just a single telescope because the wavelengths we're using are so long. When you add several of them together and make an interferometer, you can make much more detailed pictures of the sky. You get a much, much better resolution. The downside to that is, along with your much better resolution, is you get a very, very, very small field of view on the sky. And when we combine the signals together in a correlator, the only way to increase your field of view is to either have very, very, very short time integrations or very, very narrow spectral channels. And both of those processes mean you end up with very, very big data sets in ordinary correlators. But what we're trying to do here is actually use a software correlator, which is a bit different. Most of the correlators around the world at the moment are actually hardware correlators, so they're limited in how flexible they are by what hardware is actually built into the things. But if you've got a software correlator, the only limit really is how much you can program into it and how many processes and how much memory you can throw at the thing. So in principle, you can do an awful lot more with a software correlator than you can with a hardware correlator. So what we're actually trying to do is trying to image really, really wide fields of view using a software correlator. So we've got some code that's new into this correlator that will actually let you image what's called the entire primary beam of the telescope. So you can think of the primary beam as sort of the field of view of one single telescope in your array. So if you've got a 25-meter telescope, radio telescope, at a frequency of 1.4 gigahertz, your primary beam is about half a degree on the sky. If you've got an interferometer, then your actual resolution is much, much smaller than that, but you only ever see a tiny part of that half a degree size field of view. But what we can do with the software correlator is actually image the entire primary beam, image that entire half a degree.
So you're sort of splitting it into lots of little separate fields of view, but you're getting them all at the same time.
Yeah, you can still run one run of the correlator, so you don't have to recorrelate many, many times. But what you do is you basically shift to each of these little individual positions, make an image, and then you can tile the images and make it up like a mosaic. And what you can end up with is an image that covers the whole half a degree primary beam, but might have, you know, a billion pixels or something. So these are really, really detailed images over very large areas of the sky for a radio interferometer. So this is quite an interesting technique, and it's something that's going to be very much more common with the new radio telescopes that are coming online. So the pathfinders for the Square Kilometre Array, most of these are wide field instruments, and they're a few years down the line before they're fully operational. And these kind of techniques that we're working on are the kind of things that these telescopes are going to be doing sort of as standard. And the test piece that we've used for this is we did an observation earlier this year where we've actually looked at the Andromeda Galaxy, M31. And most interferometers, so the very large array in New Mexico has quite a wide field of view because it's a small interferometer. And the images that we get from the VLA, you can do it sort of in, you know, maybe 7 observations and you can cover the entire disk. What we're doing with the VLBI is we're trying to image an entire half a degree field at VLBI resolution, which is going to be, it's the number of pixels is just ridiculous. It's going to be an incredibly large data set when we've finished. And it's going to be the most detailed radio image of M31 that's ever been made.
So as computers become more powerful, that's effectively making your telescopes better.
Yeah, that's right. Every year as computers get better, so we're following that Moore's Law trend. In fact, if you look at the computing requirements for the Square Kilometre Array, it relies on Moore's Law continuing over the next 10, 15 years. If Moore's Law does break down in the next 10, 15 years in terms of development, then the Square Kilometre Array is going to have a bit of a problem with its data processing.
So we need the computers to keep on getting better, basically.
Absolutely. The numbers actually work out that when the SKA is built, if we get the computer that we currently think we need to do the data processing, it's going to be one of the top 100 supercomputers in the world when it's built.
Right. Have you in Perth done any interferometry all the way from where you are to the UK?
Not myself, no, but the technique, it does happen. Actually, one thing that's happened fairly recently down here was a project that actually, so we're building one of these demonstrators for the Square Kilometre Array up in the outback, about 10 hours drive inland from Perth and north a bit. So there's a few antennas that have gone up there now, and there's a new telescope that's just been commissioned in New Zealand. So normally VLBI in Australia was a few telescopes on the east coast around sort of Sydney going down to there's one down in Hobart in Tasmania, and there's one at Ceduna, which is over near Adelaide. And that was the VLBI array in Australia. But now they've actually managed to add in one of these new telescopes from Western Australia and the telescope in New Zealand. So for the first time, we've got continent-sized arrays of telescopes that are actually operational in Australia as well. So that's quite exciting. And in principle, yeah, we can, well, in fact, they have in the past linked some of the Australian telescopes to the European array, to other telescopes in Asia, to the telescope at Hartebeestuk in South Africa. And so you can, in principle, you can make a telescope the size of planet Earth.
So just coming back to Jodrell again for a minute, I had one recollection of a star party that you were involved with when you were here, and you demonstrated a meteor detector that I think you'd at least helped to build yourself. Practical radio astronomy, actually building receivers and stuff, is something that most of us don't get our hands on nowadays. So could you tell us a bit about what you did then?
Yeah, it's kind of a shame that that's sort of not so common anymore, that people actually get to play with bits of hardware. That telescope, the meteor detector, was the hardware was built by Eddie Blackhurst, who's an engineer at Jodrell. I think he was actually interviewed on the Jodcast, I think it was last year, about the project. So what we did was we were interested in looking at the radio echoes from meteor trails in the atmosphere, because this is one of the things that was basically the reason why Jodrell exists in the first place, because Sir Bernard Lovell during the Second World War was working on the development of radar, and he noticed that the radar operators were seeing echoes on their screens that they weren't reporting as aircraft, and he wanted to know what they were. And he thought they may be due to cosmic rays. And when the war finished and he went back to Manchester, he borrowed some radar equipment from the army and took it with him back to the university. And at the time, where the physics department was, where he set the equipment up in the quadrangle, it was right next to Oxford Road, where there was a tram line. And trams, electric sparks, generate radio waves. So that was a really, really bad place to put a piece of radio equipment. So he couldn't use it there, so he had to take it somewhere else. And eventually, after trying a few other places and finding they didn't work so well, he eventually found that there was a botanical station that the university owned, which was at Jodrell Bank. So he took the equipment out there, and there have been sort of radio astronomers on the site ever since. So when it got to the 50th anniversary of the telescope in 2007, one of the things we did as a sort of way to show the public how radio astronomy started, basically in northwest of England, was to build one of these instruments. It was slightly different to the way Lovell did it in the early days, because that was actually radar. So they would transmit a pulse of radio waves up into the sky and listen for the reflections coming back. But these days, because we're listening to really faint signals coming from the universe with the rest of the telescopes at Jodrell, we obviously don't want to be transmitting signals. So we ask people to turn off their mobile phones, for example, when they come onto site. So what we did instead was we said, okay, well, we can still do radar. We'll just do over the horizon radar. So we let somebody else be the transmitter and we pick up the reflections. And what we were using as the transmitters were European television stations, the old analog transmitters, because they work at a very good frequency that's perfect for this sort of work. you can't normally pick them up because they're over the horizon, so you don't get the direct signal. The only time you actually see them is when you get a reflection off something high up in the atmosphere, such as a meteor trail. So that's what we did, and it worked quite successfully for a couple of years, but because Europe are now mostly switching over to the digital transmitters, we're actually losing those signals that we can use, because the digital band is actually a lot higher in frequency, and it means that it doesn't work quite so well for meteors. So sadly, it's not working very well at the moment, but we'll see.
Okay, so you like to get your hands onto the actual hardware as well as just taking observations and analysing the data.
Personally, I find that if I can actually get hands-on with a piece of equipment, I understand the theory behind it a lot better than if I just look at some equations on a page. So I really like playing with bits of hardware. I always have done. So it was quite good fun to actually build that and test it and work out why it wasn't working and manage to fix it and get it all installed. So I really enjoyed that kind of thing.
I enjoyed that one because it allowed us to actually do some observations on a cloudy day. There were a lot of people at the visitor centre who otherwise wouldn't really have been able to see anything. A cloudy night, I should say. But we were able to get these little flashes on the screen every time a meteor came along and ionised the air in the atmosphere.
That's right. There were a few star parties where the weather didn't play, but luckily we had the technology. We could see through the clouds with our radio waves. So,
the very last thing I wanted to ask you was, how does Perth compare to the plains of Cheshire? How do you find life and work in these two different, very different places?
Well, they're both pretty flat. Cheshire is definitely greener and a lot wetter. Perth is actually a nice city. A lot of people say Perth is really boring. And that was, a lot of people told me that before I moved here, but I've actually found the cities, there's always stuff happening. It's just not quite so easy to find as it would be in, say, Manchester. So, yeah, it's an interesting city, and it's a really nice place to live. I've had a lot of fun here. I've met a lot of astronomers. When I arrived in 2008, there were about 6 astronomers in my department at Curtin. There's now more like 30 of us, and there's an equivalent number across the river at the University of Western Australia. So the radio astronomy community in Western Australia has grown incredibly in the last 3 years, and largely because, of course, of the Square Kilometre Array, which obviously the Australians are hoping will end up being built here in Australia.
Well, you certainly make the Jodcast global for us anyway. You've straddled the whole world of radio astronomy, literally.
And have I picked up an accent?
I don't think your accent has changed much. It was always fairly broad, but I can't detect an Aussie twang at the moment. Do you think you've picked one up?
Well, some people seem to think I have. I'm undecided. But that was one of the questions I think Nick asked me in the last show before I left Manchester. So are you going to be giving us the news with an Australian accent in a few months?
Okay, well, thank you very much for talking to us.
No problem.